It would be nice if we remember to take some pictures during this weekend, so we have a record of our first retreat here. I know none of us are really the kind of people who take pictures all the time, but it would be nice that as a group too we could see who was here, and because in years to come we will appreciate it. I know that in Portugal, Christina is accumulating pictures from, I think she's basically doing it from the Jukais, right? When people...
Not just, but yeah.
Yeah. So she's looking for pictures of when each person, pictures of the person with me, actually, when they did Jukai, and...
Yes, there's a Jukai album.
Right. So those of you who did Jukai, she will probably be contacting you and asking you if you have pictures. So, but it was interesting because when I was talking to her about it, she said, yes, we have pictures from 2006 when we did the first summer retreat in Portugal. And, or no, actually I think it was 2007. Yeah, it was 2007, yeah. And I said, oh, so you don't have any from before that, from before 2007. She said, well, we have one. It was the first one I was at, she was at. It was in Porto. And she said, but there, you mean you came before and there were other activities before? And I said, well, yes, I started coming in 2004. But because she had only come in 2007, I don't think she realized what was going on before she arrived. So I'm not sure we have any pictures before that. So if you can think of anyone you might ask in Portugal who has pictures. I'm going to ask Miriam if she has pictures, because she came with me in those days. I really think Margarita must have some. Margarita in Porto. But, and in France, I think we have a lot, probably.
No, we do.
I think we do. If we accumulated them. But because we definitely have from Caroline's in 2006, definitely have pictures of that. At Julian Delphine's and at Red Earth, probably not. It's too bad. Because that's 12 years of activity that we never took pictures of. So anyway, just keeping a record.
We're getting better.
We are getting better, actually. It's different. Say, getting different. although ultimately, the pictures, the records, aren't really worth anything. If there isn't what goes on, if what goes on there is not grounded in our practice. So, so what is our practice? I was thinking about it after last night's talk. And thinking this week about what we do here this weekend. And then just when I was sitting down to do my sitting here, and I put my book down and I realized the notebook that I have, it's from Niki de Saint-Phalle with this famous picture of her. I don't know if anyone knows who she is. She was quite an extraordinary artist. In the 60s, 70s. And she did this series of paintings where she would fill little balloons with paint, you know, ballons qu'on gonfle. She would fill them with paint And but they were small, you know, it was just a little bit of paint in each one, so it was a little small thing like this. And she would put it all over the canvas, and then she would take a gun and shoot at the canvas. And when the, I don't think it had, I think it was maybe a BB gun or something, you know, I don't think it was bullets per se. And then that was what was the painting was. And it was more elaborate than that too. It was like a whole happening. You know, and she would invite people to come and have other people put the things on there, and then even have other people shoot. But this is a picture of her shooting in one of her things, and it's quite a famous picture. Picture actually. But then she made this whole list of je tire, ça s'appelle le mur de la rage.
De la rage?
Oui. Je tire sur, and then she made this whole list, la faim, la soif, l'injustice, la misère, la cruauté, l'indifférence, la torture physique, la torture mentale, la maladie, le racisme, la souffrance, la mort, la respectabilité, la bêtise, le fanatisme religieux, la méchanceté, la sida, les camps de concentration, les goulags. She has this whole list, 84 things that, and this is her actual handwriting. And the last one is, the last one is, je tire sur la condition humaine. Anyway, so I was thinking, oh, je tire sur quoi? What am I shooting at? What are we shooting at? What are we doing here? And she's like, doing it right at me, right at you. So that's what we're, that's what you take aim at. Although it could be this. So, but what does that mean? There's this Zen joke, something like the student asks, does reincarnation exist or something like that? And the teacher says, well, how should I know? And the student says, well, because you're a Zen master. And the teacher says, but I'm not a dead Zen master. A dead Zen master. Because the whole thing is, this whole thing we do is about, you know, what we call direct experience, direct knowing. Prajna is, you know, knowledge, but, or wisdom, but direct knowledge or wisdom. It's not about something in a book or something, learning a system or even having a French would say a grille through which you look at something to understand it.
Framework.
What?
A framework.
Exactly. Not even about that. Yeah. And what I said last night about, you know, the kind of nice little report about the pagoda in Vansin with all the nice Buddhist music and the bells and the lamas and all that stuff. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with that, but it can be misunderstood as, okay, this is a whole setup, a whole framework, and that's what it's about. And I'm kind of like her in that sense, well, I'm going to shoot at that. shoot at the notion of believing that the framework is what it's about. So, and the thing is that we put in place these frameworks and these systems because it gives us something that we can lean on, let's say, in which to open up to what doesn't have a framework, what does not have, that where there is nothing to lean on. And sitting is one of those frameworks, you could say. Although sitting is not just sitting here and doing nothing, right? There's more to it than that. But it's through this sitting that we gradually cultivate or awaken to things as they are, to see things as they are. And someone gave this really good example of people sometimes, there was a question in the evening with Norman, someone asked a question kind of similar to this, where it was like, well, you know, I think it was Michel-Ange's question, something like, well, all these people are doing this thing together, and, you know, and then when you step out of it, you're saying, they're all crazy, what are they doing, you know, what are they, what is all this stuff, you know, this person is saying this stuff, and they're just believing it, and, but that's not, I don't believe that, and I'm not going to do it, you know, or something like that, remember Michel-Ange's question, something like that, yeah. And, so this is often a misunderstanding that we think that, yes, okay, you're being brainwashed, someone is telling you all this stuff, and so you just believe it. Well, if that's what's happening, then, yeah, don't stay, because that's not what it's about, right? But what it's about is seeing for yourself what this person is talking about. Because this person has seen it, or they wouldn't be sitting here. This is the ideal situation, right? I would say, in my experience, the person sitting here has seen it and is telling you about it and is inciting you to see it for yourself. It's not saying, understand this, believe it, and memorize it or something. It's not like that. And so someone, I read this illustration, this example, where someone said it's like if a blind person regains his view, his vision.
Sight.
What? Sight, yeah. And so then this person who has regained his sight and someone who can see already would agree that the leaves in the tree here in the summertime are basically the same color as the grass, green in the summertime. And then in the autumn it changes and the leaves are a different color. But another blind person who has not seen that could think, well, they're just agreeing on something. It's not my experience. I don't know that. So I just have to accept that. But I could also say, well, I'm not going to believe what they say. They just have agreed on this thing that the leaves are green in the summer and they're brown in the fall. And I'm, you know, it doesn't mean anything to me. My experience is not that. This guy was using this as an illustration of that's what this is like. It's not like suddenly two people are just agreeing to believe something. It's that that's what they're seeing, things as they are, before our opinions and ideas have been placed upon them. You know, like the tree is big or the tree is small or the tree is good or the tree is not good or rain is nice or rain is not nice. You know, Brigitte and I had this brief conversation yesterday where she really liked the rain. She was really happy because it reminded her of when she previous experience she'd had when it was refreshing after the heat of summer and whatever, you know. I didn't like the rain. And it doesn't mean that there's the rain is good or bad. It's just we had two completely different experiences that we were expressing of the rain. It doesn't mean my experience was wrong and hers was right, or vice versa. It's just what it is. So what is the rain before we put all of that into it? This is what we see when we see. That's what this practice is about, is seeing the rain before Brigitte likes it and I don't like it. And it's not that because Brigitte likes it, she can appreciate it differently better than me because I don't like it. It's not about liking it so that you appreciate it, or not liking it so that you appreciate it. It's about not putting these things on it, on the rain. And if we look at all of our, you know, there's like a whole range of things in our lives that we do this with. Often it's with emotions. So if you take something like anger, this is like rain. So then there's anger and emotion, which is a phenomenon that's arising, like rain arises. And if we don't put our thought into it, it cannot grow and continue, the anger. But as soon as we start thought, which is the equivalent of our ideas or our opinions or whatever it is, it's like a fire that we are putting fuel into with thought, with our thoughts. But if we take if we go back to this prajna or this direct knowing, sometimes we say it's intuition, it's intuitive, but it's more than that. It's not just a gut feeling, it's more than that. But it's true that it's not only involved with the intellect and thought, what we think usually of. This direct knowing will get to the root of the anger. So what is the essence of it? What is its origin? Who is angry? And that's not a thought. Often we think, okay, so I'm supposed to direct my thoughts so that I'm asking who is angry. Well, that can be a structure, a framework through which we attempt to get to the root of it. But that's not actually what it's about. It's about even letting go of that. You know, someone said, oh, so yesterday, so are we supposed to always be... What was it? I think, Lisa, you asked it. It was something like...
Check. Do you need to check?
Oh, yeah. Do you need to
check? The consequences.
Right, exactly. Check. And that's actually impossible because it's direct. The cause and the effect are one, in fact. So as soon as we start looking for it, we're going away from it, in fact. Of course, it can help to take things apart. And like I said, you know, the constellation familiale, or, you know, explore through other techniques, psychoanalysis or something. You know, priceless, really, those things are priceless and very, very important to do. But at the same time, when we're talking about prajna, that's not what we're talking about. Prajna includes it all, includes that and not that. So it's everything. Something, you know, a lot of people now, it's very trendy to say that neuroscience is getting to the same... is exploring the same issues of Buddhism, so the big trend these days. And there is a lot of crossover, and there is a lot of sharing, and it's interesting to explore it. However, the limits of science are that it's based on analysis. It's based on analyzing facts or experience, Whereas what we're talking about, this prajna, includes that and more. So it's a wholeness, it's a whole wisdom. It's not just analyzing. That can help, that can be part of what goes on. But, you know, a scientist will analyze things. And so when we talk about Dharma transmission, you know, transmission, so okay, so I'm sitting here and I received transmission, you say, which is really not a good word. It's a perfectly fine word. However, there's such a... we have so much attached to this, what transmission is. You know, we think that there's something here, something here, and something is transmitted from here to here, right? Well, that's not it, though. That's not what happens. Dharma transmission is basically when the teacher acknowledges that the student sees what he sees. You know, it's like the person regaining sight, and they see the same leaves. They see the nature of being, you see the nature of reality. And the teacher acknowledges that the student sees that. That's all it is, really. It's not, nothing is transmitted in the sense that you receive something that you didn't have from this person. Of course, we think that. And there's a big misconception around that. And there's the great, great koan about this, where the story of the sixth patriarch, who, I mean, maybe I should tell the whole story, I don't know. Does everyone remember the story of the sixth patriarch or not? Yeah, that's, that comes eventually, but yeah. Mm-hmm. Not, should I tell it? Okay. So the sixth patriarch was this woodcutter, illiterate, whose father had died when he was quite young. And his, so he supports his mother by cutting wood and selling it in the marketplace. And one day he's in the marketplace, and at the time this was in, I think the 9th century in China, probably 9th century. At the time it was very common in the marketplace for, not only in China, but this was also going on in the Middle East, in marketplaces, probably in Europe, maybe not at that time, later, for, you know, gurus or spiritual people or holy men or whatever, to be in the marketplace and to be talking, reciting texts or talking to people, teaching in the marketplace like this, telling stories, whatever. And so he, this woodcutter, hears something from what this monk is saying, the Zen monk, from the Diamond Sutra, and I can't remember what the phrase is. Does anyone remember? No. Okay. Doesn't really matter so much. And suddenly, he understands, sees it, and wants to, and asks the guy where he came from. And, you know, he said, I've come from the north or whatever, and tells him where it was and tells him what the text was that he was saying or whatever. So the woodcutter decides that he's going to go and find this place to learn more about this. So he leaves his mother. I don't know exactly how he managed to support her, but he leaves his mother and he goes off. And he arrives at this monastery, and because he's illiterate, and the monks in the monasteries at the time were the elite. They were the wealthy people, the educated people, people with connections. He's not allowed to enter the monastery. But whoever receives him asks him why he came, whatever, and goes and tells the abbot this. And so the abbot says, well, put him in the kitchen not even in the kitchen, like in the back yard, and have him clean the rice. And rice was like the main food that everybody ate, and so it was a big job to clean the rice, and it was not only washing it, but you had to sift it. I don't know exactly the process, but sift the holes off of it or something. And so it was a long, laborious, tedious thing that nobody wanted to do, so they put this guy there doing it. And one day the abbot comes by and says, so are you sifting it or something? Or is the rice... is the rice clear or something like that? And the guy, the sixth patriarch, too bad I don't have the book here, but sixth patriarch says something to the effect of, yes, but it's not done yet, or something like that. And so the abbot says, this guy is interesting. You know, if he could respond to me in that way. And the abbot is getting old, and in those days, every teacher only had one successor. That was it. And whoever was his successor would inherit the temple, the monastery, and become the leader of the community. He was getting old and he needed to find a successor. Actually, he thought he had found him in this guy who was cleaning the rice, but he wasn't sure. So he decides to have a contest. And he said, everyone can write their understanding on the wall in a certain place, and I will decide whoever writes the most clear and the best thing will be my successor. And everyone in the community is sure that it's going to be the head monk, the most senior guy, he's been there forever, it's clear that's who it's going to be. So no one else even enters the contest. Maybe the guy put pressure on everyone else to not enter the contest, I don't know. And so he writes his thing on the wall. And it said something like, you have to, the body, the mind is like a mirror. The stand is the body. The body is the stand. And the practice is just continually cleaning the dust off. Something like this. Of course, it was more poetic. It was a poem. That's the idea. So the guy in the kitchen, who becomes the sixth patriarch, asks someone to read it for him. He hears about the contest and he hears everyone talking about it, and he asks for someone to tell him what was said on the wall. So some guy reads it to him, and then he asks someone else to, if they would write something for him on the wall, because he can't write. Said, will you write something for me? And the guy thinks he's crazy. He said, who are you? You're just this guy in the backyard cleaning the rice. You don't know anything. And he said, yeah, but I want to write something. I want to put something anyway. And so he puts his poem, which is there is no mirror, there is no stand. How could there be any dust to clean? And everyone reads this and is stunned. No one knows who it is, though, because he didn't sign it. And the abbot hears about it, goes to see it, and immediately erases it. And goes to see finds out who wrote it, though, and goes to see him. And maybe this is when he has his meeting with him about the rice, the thing with the rice, and tells him to come to his quarters at midnight that night. And he does this because he knows that if the others find out about it, he's going to give him transmission. He sees that he sees what he sees, right? And he knows that he's going to do this, but he knows that if the others find out about it, they will kill him. it would create a, there would be a revolt and they would kill the guy. Or it would be his life would be in danger anyway. So he calls him at midnight in secret and does the transmission, gives him the bowl and the robe, that's Buddha's bowl and Buddha's robe, and officially makes him his successor, and tells him that he has to leave, that he can't stay, that he has to go, he has to disappear and deepen his practice and reemerge at some point elsewhere, away from this place. And so he accompanies him to the gate, shows him off, and he goes off. Well, the monks find out about it the next day. First they notice that the guy cleaning the rice is gone, and then they hear about it, and a group of them get together and go off to chase the guy to find him. They want the bowl and the robe, and they don't want that guy to have it. So the leader of this group is called Monk Mio, and finally they catch up with him. And he's hiding. He hides. He knows they're coming. He hides and he puts the robe and the bowl on a rock beside the road. And when they arrive, he comes out and he says, you know, they say something, you know, they're mad at him or something. And he says, take it if you can. Take the robe and the bowl if you can. And Monk Mio comes forward and goes to take the bowl and the robe and can't. And breaks down and says to the guy, I didn't come for the bowl and the robe. I came for the teaching. No, wait. Yes, he says that. And so he says, teach me, brother. Oh, brother, teach me. And the guy, and the sixth patriarch says, before a thought of good and evil, what is the true face of Monk Mio? Monk Mio breaks out in a sweat and suddenly realizes. He hears it. Before a thought of good and evil, what is the true face of Monk Mio? So before we've put all of our stuff into it, what is it? Who are you? And Monk Mio breaks out into a sweat and suddenly sees something. And says, oh, you know, you truly are my teacher now. I will never defy you again, or something like that. And the sixth patriarch says, no, if what you say is true, return and we are both return to who is both our teacher, who is our teacher, the teacher of both of us. He tells him to go back to the monastery and goes on his way then, the sixth patriarch, and disappears, lives under bridges, forages for food, becomes a hermit beggar for like 20 years or something. And when he reappears, he comes to a monastery to ask for food. And there are two monks out in front of the monastery, and they're having a dispute. And he asks them what the dispute is. And one says, he says, it's the flag that's moving. I say, it's the wind that's moving. Which is it? And the sixth patriarch, who looks like basically a clochard, says, it's not the wind that's moving, it's not the flag that's moving, it's your mind that's moving. The guys are stunned, And they bring him in, they're like, who are you? And they bring him into the monastery, and he meets the abbot, and the abbot, of course, this guy has become legendary. Nobody knows where he is or who he is, the sixth patriarch, but talking to him and hearing what he says and everything, he suspects that's who it is. And finally, he admits that that's who he is. And so he stays there, practices with this guy, becomes a monk, and then becomes known, and goes back to his original monastery and becomes the sixth, takes over and whatever. And had many successors. It did not, at that point is when it became multiple successors. So, that's the story. The reason I tell the whole story is because of Monk Mio saying, him saying to him, before I thought of good and evil, what is your original face? So, before all of this, what is it? Before the rain is good or the rain is bad, what's the rain? Who are you? Before this and that, before coming and going, before sitting, standing, before eating, drinking, whatever, what is it? Before I start feeding my anger with this and that, what is it? All the rest is just decoration. No, it's just decoration. So all of the pretty songs and the bells and all of that. It's not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's just that that's not the point of it. It's funny because we talked about the Dalai Lama last night, and Guillaume sent us that link as well about hearing the Dalai Lama's teachings. But before Guillaume had sent that, I just happened to receive something from someone. So it went on my email when I came home. A little clip of the Dalai Lama, someone asking him about Muslim terrorists, Islamic terrorists, right? And he becomes really almost angry, very strong Dalai Lama, and he said, Muslim terrorists, Buddhist terrorists, it's not possible to use those two words together. The basis of all religions is love, compassion, benevolence, goodwill, I forget, a whole series of things like that. That's the basis of all religions. Every single religion, that's the basis of it. And as soon as you go against that and you foster hate, exclusion, violence, abuse, whatever it is, you no longer can call yourself a Buddhist, a Muslim. You cannot, because that's not what it's about. So, this whole thing of Islamic terrorists, it's not what it seems. The Dalai Lama can say this because that's his experience. It's not something he's learned, but he knows. His wisdom, his being is that love and that compassion and that benevolence and that kindness and that good willingness and all of that. That's what he is. That's what we all are. But we don't see it because we're putting all of this stuff, this decoration, on top of it. And then we confuse the decoration for what is. Now, probably the Dalai Lama, it was just a very small clip. Probably after that, what I was saying looked kind of like fierceness, almost like rage. Immediately after that, it was probably gone. And then it was something else. He wasn't feeding that with thought, you know, and then starting to then blame the people from countries where these people come from, or blame the imams who don't, you know, people say should be doing something about this, or whatever. You know, he didn't get into any of that. He went to the root. He used that prajna wisdom of his to get to the root of it. So even, I mean, Nikki de Saint-Phalle, I mean, I doubt that she was someone whose life was about prajna wisdom. Doesn't matter. She was expressing the same thing at this moment. And then, you know, something, she's saying this rage is coming from the same origin. Of course, then she doesn't have a way to channel it and cultivate it in the way that you can if you sit down on a cushion and meditate. Or, you know, people talk about, athletes, they often talk about being in the zone, which means it's a kind of state in which you are one with whatever it is. You know, I often talk about the famous Zidane kick in a soccer match. He was one. That was a moment of oneness with everything around him. But it's limited. Unless you pursue a way to cultivate that, it doesn't have to be Zen meditation, but to cultivate that prajna, in that moment, that was an expression of prajna. Everything's an expression of prajna, but let's say that was an expression of oneness in that moment. Everything was in perfect harmony. But the same thing can happen in music, in all the arts, can even, you know, happen when in intellectual research, cooking, it can happen any time. The difference, however, with what we do is that what sitting and cultivating it does is it broadens it so that it includes everything, not just that one moment or that one field. It's something that transcends throughout your entire life, transcends one little thing, one moment on the cushion, and is widened into the whole of life, in the universe. Now, I often tell the story of when I was at my first retreat, and my first real retreat. It was a 3-day retreat, and there were no talks, there were no interviews. Maybe there was a talk, but the guy was Japanese, and he really couldn't understand what he was saying, you know. I didn't understand what he was saying anyway, no matter what he was saying. Even if he was speaking perfect English, I wouldn't have understood what he was saying. And after the first day, one, it was super painful because I was not used to sitting for that long. I was used to sitting 20 minutes by myself at home, maybe with a 10-minute walking period and then another 20 minutes. But this was like, and the periods were 40 minutes. Every period was 40 minutes. And really uncomfortable, like painful, painfully uncomfortable, and boring, like so boring. I thought I was going to die. You know, I've told this story before. I was like, I can't do this. And I was really, it was somewhere in Alsace. And I arrived there with people in a car who I didn't even know. And so I had nowhere, I couldn't leave. You know, good thing I couldn't leave. I don't think I would have left anyway, but, you know. I couldn't leave. There was nowhere to go. It was like out in the countryside. It was Toussaint, so it was like cold and whatever else. You couldn't really go outside. And it was just so boring and uncomfortable and painful, you know. This was after the first day. So the second day, you know, after the morning sitting or something, I was like, I have to do something. I can't do this, you know. And I remembered that, of course, a few months before when I had started sitting, they had taught me to count my breath. but I wasn't doing it. Count your breath, no, forget it.
To do what?
To count my breath. And I didn't do it. I wasn't doing it. But so I said, well, you know, I may as well try because I don't know what else to do. It was like just excruciating. And I happened to be sitting, this was also facing the wall, right? And in really tight circumstances. But I happened to be sitting right in front of a huge bay window. So, you know, and I could overlook the hills, the Alsace, I don't know what that is, the Vosges or something, whatever it was. And so I said, okay, well, I'm going to do it. And I started doing it. You know, moment after breath, moment after moment, period after period, all day long. And by the end of the third day, it wasn't boring anymore. And it wasn't uncomfortable anymore. I mean, of course, still my body was hurting, you know, because I wasn't used to it physically. But at one point, I looked up there, and the hills were breathing. And at the end, the teacher asked us to all go around, and this was like the first moment when we could speak, you know. There was no talking except it was a dortoir. So the women were all in one dortoir and the men were all in another. And I just have this memory of sitting there in the middle of this dortoir and all these women around me, and I was just sitting there telling them about Roshi, you know, about my teacher. Here I am in some other guy's retreat, and I'm talking about my teacher. And one of the people there was so enthusiastic, she actually came, and she's still there, Ida. And so that was the only talking that we did, and I guess I was the one doing the talking, and probably to distract myself from the discomfort or something, I don't know. And so at the end, he asked us all to go around and say something about just, I don't know what the instruction was, like what happened for you here, or where, I don't remember what the instruction was. But when it came to me, I was almost towards the end, when it came to me, I said, the only thing I can say is, I'm just breathing. And he looked at me and he said, is it you breathing or the universe? And I did, there was like, it was one of these moments where I just said, it's the same thing. And it wasn't like I had thought of that beforehand, but that it was true. It is true. I'm telling you, it is true. It's like the universe and you are you universe, right? It's not something separate. And for me, that was a direct experience of it. It wasn't me breathing or the universe breathing. It was the same thing. Everything was breath. So I tell you, and I always, that's why I say to people, if you really do that breathing practice, if you really, really do it, it will change your life. But very few people really, really do it, and I don't know why. I mean, I do to an extent because I didn't do it. I mean, I know. But I didn't do it until I was confronted with a situation where I was desperate. I mean, I really, it was like, I had nothing else to do. I was really up against the wall, as we say, and no choice. It was either that or die. I mean, I thought that's what it was. You know? I was forced into it by the circumstances. But fortunately, I was forced into it because it changed my life. So, the universe and you are not separate. And even when we talk about, so, oh yeah, that was that thing last night, when the question about, you know, so should we check and see, you know, whatever. And the thing is with this, with what we call being mindful or being aware, you know, it's total. So it's not like I am aware of the bird singing or I am aware of my glasses. or I'm mindful of my glasses, or I'm mindful of the tea or something. Of course it's that, but it's also the tea is mindful of you. The bird is aware of you. You are aware of you. The bird is aware of the bird. The bird is aware of the bird and you being aware of each other. It's this mindful and this awareness is much more than what, you know, unfortunately the mindfulness practices that they do today are pretty much focused on just me being mindful of this, right? And that's, of course, that's a step, but it's much more than that. So it's not only just observing, okay, checking to see am I aware of this or that, but it's far more than that. The universe is aware. Awareness is the universe. So, and you are the universe. You are awareness. So, it must be about 1 o'clock if Jill left, right?
Yeah.
It's 1 o'clock? Yeah. So, questions or comments or...
Something. Just before, when you mentioned Zidane and the thing, the kick, it was one. And right after that, you said that they said that was an expression of Prajna, that holiness. And then right after that, you said, but everything is an expression of Prajna.
Yeah.
What exactly? Because I always, there is this tendency to separate. There are those moments we should cultivate, as you say.
Mm-hmm.
And there are moments, especially afterwards, that you understand that you were not, because you were just caught up in some anger or you were just distracted or something. Usually afterwards, you. So how is that, and how is everything an expression of Prajna when you are not mindful of the present moment, you're not aware?
Because, so then this is, we are focused on me, so we think if I don't see it, it's not happening, right? Or it's only mu if I see that it's mu. But everything is mu, whether I see it or not, right? Prajna is the wisdom of things as they are. So it's, whatever it is prajna. It's just what it is. It's like we said last night. It's just someone's path. Not the way that we die. It's just what it is. It's our path. The way we are born, where we live, whatever. It's just what it is. So everything is prajna. It's an expression of prajna in that sense. You know, we can take it really, really far and say, you know, horrible, horrible things are prajna. Well, they are. It doesn't mean that we don't see them. We see, when we truly see them what they are, for what they are, we then, this compassion, this love, this good willingness arises or something, and we act according to that. So we don't foster the horror, you know, or the terrible thing, whatever it is. When we truly see it for what it is, you know, the 9/11, the absolute horror, you know. But I mean, not only 9/11, car bombs in Baghdad happen all the time. You know, hundreds and thousands of people have died in terrorist attacks, more than that even probably, throughout time and space. But in the West, we focus so much on 9/11, so I'll just use that as an example, you know. The people who committed that, who did that, if we look at it from the prajna point of view, which is actually not a point of view, it's as it is, we can see, we can feel, it's even physical, we can feel their suffering. Because if they weren't suffering, they wouldn't do it. You wouldn't fly an airplane into a building and kill people if you weren't suffering. And I mean by that, living in a deluded belief of separation, of difference. The American army that goes and bombs people, it's the same thing. They're suffering there too. you wouldn't do that if you didn't believe in some sort of separation. That I am right and you are wrong. And so before this thought of good and evil, what is it? So the good and evil is also prajna. It's all one. Now, of course, it's important to be able to distinguish and make differences, because immediately what our mind does then is, okay, so then there is no good and evil, so then we can do anything. Then we can bomb people and blow people up and abuse people and steal. We don't have to take care of anything. But it's the exact opposite. When you see that it's before the good and evil, then we take care of each and everything. We see everything is important. It's not that nothing is important. It's that everything is important. Everything has value. When we see that everything is a manifestation of prajna.
There's a poem by Wendell Berry that just two lines, it says, after all these analyses, the fact remains intact.
Who wrote this?
Wendell Berry.
Can you translate, please?
Après toutes ces analyses, le fait reste intact.
Le fait.
Ah,
le fait.
C'est un auteur de quelle nationalité qui écrit ça?
C'est American.
American poet.
On m'a dit récemment que c'était la seule chose qui comptait dans l'esprit asiatique, c'était les faits. C'était les faits et le faire.
Qui a dit ça?
Quelqu'un qui m'a dit ça par rapport à l'esprit asiatique. Et en particulier par rapport à la pratique zen, à l'assise. C'est le faire. En référence à ce que tu m'avais dit. La seule chose, c'est l'assise.
And then, of course, we because we have sat and we cultivate, we open, we cultivate, we look, we explore, whatever, when we then get up and do, it's different. We move in the world differently because of this. But at the same time, the cause and the effect are one. We already are doing when we're sitting. And in fact, it's not we, you know, sometimes in Zen they even say, the sitting is doing me. It's not me doing sitting.
Je vais te redire tout ça en français.
Hein?
Je vais te redire ça en français.
On dit que c'est pas moi qui est en train de s'asseoir, c'est s'asseoir qui non, c'est pas moi qui fais zazen, c'est zazen qui me fait, or something like that. Quelque chose. Non?
Okay. Ouais. Tu as dit quelque chose par rapport à après la saison, on va dans le monde. Tu as dit quoi par rapport à ça?
Oui, parce que cette notion de faire, d'agir, ouais. C'est. Les conséquences de notre assise vont se manifester dans ce qu'on fait. Donc, la cause et l'effet vont être présent dans notre façon de bouger dans le monde, d'agir, d'être, d'interagir avec des gens. Non, interagir, ça ne marche pas. C'est pas un mot, c'est.
Si.
Ah oui, si.
But at the same time, Norman Fisher, what you say also is, it doesn't change you. You're still grumpy and you're still.
Exactly.
Bad moods and you still. Yeah. Your character is still whatever.
Right.
It is.
But what changes is how you experience that and how you manifest in the world. It's true, you know, it's not going to change the color of my hair. It's not going to change my size. It's not going to change the fact that I have to cut my nails. It doesn't make me a man when I'm a woman. That's true. It's true. At the same time, it changes then how I live with that. It's like Ram Dass, famous, his real name is Richard Alpert, but you know, one of the great hippie gurus of the 60s, not only a hippie guru, but you know, who went to India and found a teacher and became named Ram Dass, and wrote a book called Be Here Now. But he, when someone asked him, because he was a psychiatrist, and he was famous for experimenting, he was at Harvard, and he was famous for experimenting with LSD with Timothy Leary, who was also a psychiatrist at Harvard, and just going on to spiritual practice because of what he'd seen in his experiences with LSD. Anyway, and so someone said, so, you know, now you have no more neuroses? You know, are you, now that you're Ram Dass and this, you know, big illuminated guy, you have no more neuroses? And he laughed, you know, kind of like Norman. And he said, well, no, that's not at all what it is. It's just that they are still there, but instead of being monsters that occupy my entire being, they're just these little things that are kind of here floating around, and I'm aware of them, and they don't get in the way in the same way that they did before. You know, and I think people who have done psychoanalysis would probably have the same, come to that same, a similar type thing where it doesn't mean that you're not neurotic anymore after you've done all your analysis. It doesn't mean that you are different. You're still who you are, you know. But you experience it differently, and it doesn't get in the way in the same way. It doesn't ça te tracasse pas de la même façon. Now, of course, I'm not going to get into the similarities between analysis and Zen, but I'm just saying that this is not some, you know, extraordinary thing that only people who practice Zen can discover about.
So why Zen?
Character. Well, because why for me? Why Zen? Because this is what works for me. That's why I'm. And so I give the same answer as Norman, you know. And I think any genuine teacher would give that same answer. And if this is why I don't like go out and try to convert people, because it has to be what's right for you. It has to, you know, this is just my way.
And it might work or not.
What?
It might just be what's available.
For some people, it might.
In the place where I am, where I live, or whatever.
Might be. But then those people probably won't stay if they're just there because that's what's available.
I asked a guy, there was someone in one of the last retreats who left earlier. He didn't stay for the whole retreat. And I was kind of worried, you know, something might have happened. And so he just told me, no, I found that, you know, Tibetan Buddhism works best for me. I found it. I get
it. Right.
So, okay, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's wonderful that you know that.
So or nothing, you know, no sort of spiritual practice. It's okay, you know. This just happens to be what, for me, changed my life. And so I'm telling you, that's all I always tell you. I'm only telling you my experience. But
wouldn't we be more free without any?
Well, this is what people, you know, someone asked Maizumi Roshi that.
Est-ce qu'on serait pas plus libre si on avait, même sans avoir besoin de ça, de la pratique?
Someone asked Maizumi Roshi that, and he said, well, you know, if you can live without it, do it. Don't do it if you can live without it. You know, why bother if you can live without it? You know, why bother? And that's absolutely true. That's why I say, you know, it doesn't work if you make people come or you convince them of something, because there's no point. But the same thing is true of many, many things, you know, many disciplines. Same thing is true of psychotherapy, you know, psychoanalysis. If you make someone go, nothing's going to happen, because they're not there because they want to be there, and it speaks to them and it's meaningful. Same thing, you know, if you make a kid, parents, we realize this kind of thing, you know, if you make a kid learn the piano and it's not his thing, well, it's going to be just a struggle. Of course, there's a certain amount as parents, you know, you have to introduce things because you know that it could, a appeal to the child, but you have to know when to stop, when to let them find their own way. And this isn't even like this, you know, like bringing people here so they try it out. Although we do introductions, we do open houses, we do conferences and things so people can have a look at it if it appeals to them.
It's very experimental. There's only one way to know, is to
Try it yourself, exactly.
See what you, how you feel.
Yeah.
If it doesn't work, you go somewhere else.
And that's what Bernie Glassman's response was once when I heard him say, someone was saying, you know, how do I know if this practice is for me? You know, I've been doing it, but I don't know, and whatever. And he said, there's only one way of knowing. Do it. And two things will happen. One of two things will happen. Either, if you really do it, you will find out it's not for you, and you will discover what it is you want to do. Or you will really do it, and you will discover that it is for you. But you can't know that unless you do it. It doesn't mean that everyone has to come here and do it to find that out. But if you are doing it, and you're not sure, the only way to know is to do it. So, you know, like the breathing thing. Like I say, this technique of counting your breath, the only way to know if it, quote, works or not, because it's not about working, but that's how we think, or do I like it or not? Usually it's people, it's like, I don't like it, so I want something that I like better. It doesn't really appeal to me, counting the breath. I prefer to look at my thoughts, or I prefer to listen to the sounds or something. Well, that's fine. We can have our preferences, but the point of having a discipline is it's not about your preferences. And the power of those disciplines is that you're leaving aside what you prefer and what you don't prefer, and just doing it. And the only way to find out is to just do it. So.
And how do you work with both the koans and the counting of the breath? Si tu pratiques le koan, et comment tu associes la pratique de compter les respirations?
The way that I do it now, but you know, I've been doing this for such a long time, is I tend to use the breath as a technique to become grounded, to become unscattered, you know, like when my mind is like all over the place, or I'm like, you know, preoccupied by something that I really want to solve, or you know, I had a dispute with someone, or I really had this great experience and I'm like reliving it in my mind or something, you know, whatever it is. I come back to the breath. I use it as a coming back to here. It really anchors me and then opens me to the rest. So it's something that I come back to. It's my go-to practice, as we say, you know. Whereas koans, you know, if you're working on a koan and you're counting your breath, then it's that helps favor, that helps cultivate the ground for working with the koan too, because it opens you and takes you away from what you think or are attached to about the koan, and allows you more space to just let whatever it is arise. That's one way of working with it. You can also, you know, say, okay, today I'm just doing my breath. I'm just counting my breath. Or tonight I'm just counting my breath, whatever. But again, it's like I always tell people, you have to be strict with yourself, because basically you're just going to stray away at every opportunity, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and we're all the same way, you know. So you have to be strict and say, okay, I'm going to do it for this amount of time. It's not like, okay, I'm just going to do this for a couple minutes and see what happens. And then if I don't like it halfway through, I'll change. No, it's not. No. It's like you do it. That was what was so powerful, I know. And I've had this experience with other disciplines within this practice. What is so powerful is you don't have a choice. You just do it. This is, you know, there's no way out. And I always say that's the good news and that's the bad news. There's no way out.
And can you be with the breath without actually counting, just following? It's not as...
Maybe. I've never tried that technique. It has never really... no, it's not true. I have tried it, but it's not as powerful for me as counting. Because counting makes you do something present, you know. Whereas just following the breath, it's a little less concrete. Just a little bit less. It's concrete in the sense that you can feel your breath and whatever. But what adds the concreteness to it is the count. And that you have to remain vigilant and present, because when you get to 10, you have to start over again. And you have to keep, you know, count on the out-breath and keep track of it, which is very tight. It's a tight constraint, tighter than just following your breath. You know, there are serious, serious practices of breath, that whereas, you know, you breathe in on one nostril and not the other. I mean, you know this kind of stuff. In yoga, you do this kind of stuff. But also in meditation, there are people who do that. We have a very strict breath practice of breathing a certain way, and in this nostril or that nostril, or focusing on the right here, the nostril, you know, the beginning, and where it enters, and all this kind of stuff. I'm sure that that is a powerful practice, too. I'm not trained in that practice, so I couldn't teach anyone that practice. My husband could talk about it for 3 weeks, nonstop, but I don't know.
So how do you exactly count the breath?
How
do you do it? What do you count, like, when you breathe in and out?
You count on the out-breath. Right. So you consider it's a cycle. So you breathe in, breathe out. That's one. A cycle, or that's one breath. We don't say the breath is in and out. It's all one. And then two... three, and if you then get lost, which invariably we do, when you realize that you've become lost, you come back to zero again and start over. And we can become lost in a number of ways. It can be we lose the count. We don't remember where we are. We can find ourselves counting all the while thinking, maintaining perfectly the count. 1 to 0, 1 to 10, no problem.
Is that what really happens? Because I'm never sure. Because many times it seems like
do things at the same.
Exactly, multitasking. You know, you can be really good at multitasking.
It's really annoying.
Yeah. And that's what happens. You know, that can happen. So it's like you're doing 5 things, and you know, you're thinking about something else while you're maintaining the count, and then you're thinking about something else while you're thinking about something else while you're counting.
Is that really happening? Because I'm never sure.
Oh, it happens to me. I don't know.
It was not supposed to be possible.
Why is that not possible? The mind is incredibly powerful and smart. It can become an automatic thing. Yeah.
The most difficult for me when counting, it's because many times I'm doubtful if I actually lost count, you know, because the mind can go astray for just a bit, but I still can remember that I was like on 4.
Well, yeah, so that's what we're talking about. Yeah.
And I'm not. Should I
go
I
back
come
to zero?
Back? Should I come
go
back?
Back to zero. Yeah. Go back to zero. Or like, you
because
know,
I still can't remember. You know what I do? Do I go on?
Of course. And then pretty soon you're observing that you're doing that, and then that's another layer, you know. Yeah. And like I say, the first time I did it, I stopped myself. Suddenly I was at 120. You know, you know, so zealous. Like, I'm going to do this. Whoa.
And I once heard the story of this guy. I think it was Sarah Baldwin, a Portuguese monk. She was doing an introduction course. And there was this story she always tells about the guy who never could get to 1. He would always lose himself, you know, before coming to 1, which I thought, well.
Well, that's another problematic, you know, that's like not even being able to start.
Yeah. The sense was he would get lost immediately, and so lost that he never got to 1. Yeah. So But because of this practice thing, I read some very small thing in the last few days. But there is this zazen called zazen, and then there was this other approach. I think it's more to do with the specific sort of school, which is what they call the Shikantaza, the mm-hmm. even though Dogen apparently also could either in the translations, I mean, you can either have zazen or sometimes there is Shikantaza, which is basically, it means the same as zazen, but it's more concrete. It's just this, just nothing else than
sitting. Just sitting.
Just mm-hmm. sitting, yes. And what I read, I'm not sure if this is how it is, there is not even the breath, the attention to the breath. There is just the attention to the body, and not even to a specific point of the body, not even just the hands or the back or the legs or...
Well, and I would say there's not even attention. There's not even... It's Shikantaza.
Is there a difference? That's what I
between what?
Wanted to ask. What he calls a zen, it could either be the breath,
or the koan, or whatever.
Shikantaza, is there a difference?
Yeah. No, Shikantaza is like the most advanced practice. It's really like... I don't think I ever could have understood what Shikantaza was or experienced it until I had, you know, finished all of my koan practice and, you know, practiced for years and years and years. Because it is such... There's not even an attention. It's just sitting. You know, Bernie Glassman's favorite things, famous things when people ask him, he says, it's not just sitting, it's just sitting! It's like total... that. Nothing else, you know. Mizumi Roshi used to say, when people would come in and they would say, yeah, my practice is Shikantaza, he would always say, no, it's not. No, it's not. Now this is from our lineage's experience. In the, you know, maybe in a pure Soto lineage, they would say they're practicing Shikantaza all the time, and Shikantaza and Zazen are the same thing. Then I don't know what their distinctions would be. But in our lineage, we do work with Shikantaza and koan practice both. That's one of the characteristics of our lineage, because we have both strains.
And when you say let you take everything in, or just let everything be, if you're counting, then you're focusing on the count, and you're not. Or you're, I guess, somehow excluding everything that arises.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So. But what you are choosing to do in that moment is say, okay, what is arising is this, and I will. And this is, that's why I say I use this to bring me to a stable, quote, place, which is nowhere, which is actually not stable, but. Because my mind is so scattered, I don't experience that. So counting the breath, you know, it brings you to the universe, and you are one. If you really do it, and in that sense, then you are aware of everything. In the moment when you're doing it, no, but it's just a technique to do it. This is a technique you're being given to help you realize that, to open to things as they are. And to what they call, you know, panoramic awareness. To be able to look at the hills and not just conceptually say the hills are breathing, but the hills are breathing. The universe is breathing. I'm breathing. And everything is breathing. Everything is alive. So, yes, it's true, but it's something that we are... It's like the koans, too, you know, when you're, like, trying to figure out your koan and what is this, But ultimately, it brings you to a glimpse of absolute reality, the same thing, of things as they are. It's very fleeting, and as soon as you've seen it, it's gone, and you don't even know you've seen it sometimes. That's why it's like this such a strict thing where you have to present it and you have to go through all this. No. Because it has to be, it's a way of like putting it on in a, you know, it's like the thing of putting a beautiful painting on a white wall so that you can see it better. So this would, putting you in this circumstance, closing everything else out so that you can see it better, see things better as they are, see better things as they are, something like that.
Tu peux juste traduire en français ce que Bernie Glassman a dit, qu'il y a deux possibilités, si tu t'assis, il y a deux possibilités.
Non, il n'a pas dit qu'il y a deux possibilités, il dit que souvent on dit que Shikantaza, si tu le traduis en fait, Shikantaza, ça traduit que de juste s'asseoir.
Oui, avant, il y a 5 minutes, mais je peux poser ma question. Tu as parlé de quelque chose que disait Bernie Glassman et qu'il y avait, si tu fais enfin.
Ah, oui. C'est pratique. Quelqu'un qui lui demandait, mais est-ce que moi je sais,
oui,
si c'est pour moi,
oui.
C'est pratique. Oui. Il a dit, la seule façon de savoir, c'est de le faire vraiment.
Oui.
Et si tu le fais vraiment, il y a deux possibilités. Tu vois, soit tu vas te rendre compte que c'est absolument pour moi, soit tu vas te rendre compte que c'est pas du tout pour moi et je vais faire d'autres choses. Mais tu ne peux pas savoir ça si tu l'as pas fait entièrement. Et j'ai dit que on peut s'appliquer ça à différentes disciplines, toutes sortes de choses.
Quand tu dis le faire vraiment, c'est de vraiment, c'est
really do it, yeah. Really do it.
C'est comme la pratique. That's like the practice. I'm just going to contemplate for 5 minutes and see how it goes. No, I'm going to
really do it.
Otherwise, now I'll change. Now I'll change again.
And in the ceremony for taking the precepts, we even, you know, we ask 3 times, will you maintain this? Will you maintain it? Will you really maintain it? It's not just, yeah, I'll maintain it. It's like, really, in your flesh and blood. And it's not even, if it's really, it's not even a question of trying, because it's what you are. It's who you are. I think we should stop for lunch. Because otherwise the day will get away from us.